This is 9/11 Freefall.
Gentlemen, welcome to another episode of 9/11 Freefall. My name is Andy Steele, and I am the host. Well, this year marks the 10th anniversary of the publishing of the nanothermite paper, the paper proving the presence of active thermitic material in the World Trade Center dust. We have Niels Herit on tonight to talk about that, so that's coming your way right now.
The views expressed on this show by guests and the hosts on issues outside of the 9/11 controlled demolition evidence are the opinions of those individuals alone and do not necessarily reflect those of architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth.
Our guest today is well known in the 9/11 Truth movement for the excellent work he's done, not just 10 years ago, but continuing onward. And it's an honor to know this individual. This is Niels Herit. He was an associate professor in the Department of Chemistry at the University of Copenhagen beginning in 1975. He's published more than 60 papers in international peer-reviewed journals. His expertise is in organic chemistry, photochemistry, fluorescence, and nanotechnology. And, of course, he's the lead author on the paper, Active Thermitic Materials Discovered in Dust from the 9/11 World Trade Center Catastrophe. A very plainly stated title, but the evidence in here is explosive, no pun intended. Niels Herit, welcome back to 9/11 Freefall.
Hello, Andy, and thank you for having me on.
So, you've been on the show in the past, and I'm always aware that there's new people waking up to this evidence. I mean, for me, it's such a no-brainer. It's like hearing about the American Revolution. You just know it existed, and the 9/11 evidence, Niels Herit, and the thermite paper is just one of those facts of history for myself. But there's always people who have never even seen Building 7 coming down.
Yeah, and that is the kind of people I'm reaching out to constantly. You know, I'm spending most of my time doing presentations here in Denmark. I live in Denmark and in Vians. I'm going to Sweden tomorrow, actually. And the big challenge is to get the uninitiated in and discover Building 7 and take it from there.
And exactly.
It's a great challenge, and it takes a lot of effort to do that because, you know, there's no need to preach for the saved. So this is what I'm doing, right? And there are many people, but the number, the percentage is dropping. It was worse years ago. Now most people know, you know, somewhere everybody knows that everybody knows. But there's still a big chunk who doesn't know anything. And the kids, you know, I'm also giving presentation on schools. And if you have a gathering of 16 years old, they weren't born at that time. And they have never experienced Denmark at peace. It's different for you Americans, I know. But once upon a time, 20 years ago, we were not at war. And it hurts me a lot to realize that my grandchildren has never experienced Denmark in peace. So that's why I'm doing what I'm doing. I believe that 9/11 is the biggest war stopper. When we get through. And it started, not for me, it didn't start 10 years ago, but it's true that the publication of the nanothermite paper with Stephen Jones and Jeffrey Farah and Kevin Ryan and the other authors was a turning point in my life, definitely.
I want to delve into your life because I want to know the individuals. I think of this show as a record of history so that someday when they realize that you and Richard Gage and all of the other people that have been beating the drum on this thing for so long, when they realize that you were all right and they want to know what you did during this time period when the corporate media that should be recording this, doing this job that I'm doing, ignored us. I want them to know who these people were and how they got to where they're going. So please tell our audience, what got you into this issue of organic chemistry to begin with and got you to where you were at the University of Copenhagen?
Well, I started studying in 1963. And studying chemistry, but to become an organic chemistry, I don't know if you know there are different branches of chemistry. You can be inorganic or organic or a physical chemist or a chemical physicist or a theoretician. But I have always been keen on experiments, and that is something I have in common with Stephen Earl Jones, Professor Jones. He's a brilliant experimentalist. And it also goes through the nanothermite paper and Jeffrey Farah. I mean, so doing experiments was a driving force, definitely, and for my scientific trajectory in the 60s. And this is more or less, you know, when you look back, it may be... by chance, you end up this or there because there is one specific teacher who's particularly charismatic. So you hook up with him and follow his lead. But I've been very fortunate going into photochemistry, which is chemical processes with light, which is very important part of life, photosynthesis. For one, and the chemistry of vision, for instance, another example. But eventually I got into fast processes because you can initiate photochemical processes with a flash of light. And during my lifetime, those flashes have been shorter and shorter. So I ended up in a group where we actually could monitor chemical processes, the moving around of electrons and molecules on time scales about one millionth or one millionth of a second, which is very fast. And this is the time scale where nuclei is moving in a molecule. And that's the end of chemistry. So during my chemical scientific career, I have experienced, actually, I've reached the end of chemistry. There's nothing faster than the moving of a nuclei in a molecule. So that's kind of something. But in other ways, if maybe more important to the issue we're discussing here, is at that time the universities were free havens for thinking and knowledge. And this has changed dramatically. Our academia has been gagged, and it has, heavily influenced our efforts to inform our fellow citizens about the truth of 9/11. Because, you know, Stephen Earl Jones got out from the university a little sideways. Myself also, I'm older than Professor Jones, so I left the university at the age of 65. I was more mature for retirement, but a little sideways, a little muddy affair. And now academia has been gagged. This has also happened during my lifetime. If you would have told me that this would be the situation, if 25 years ago, I wouldn't believe you. It's frightening efficiently and fast the gagging of academia has happened. Well, that was a few comments on my academic life. And well, now I've been retired for 10 years also. Actually, the publication of the nanothermite paper was kind of related to how I got out from the university, because I struck a deal with my boss at the university, and I knew that the paper was in the print, and he didn't. So it was fitting. I was free. I didn't have anything to lose speaking out. So it was at the same time. I didn't have a job to lose, and I wasn't sacked, and he didn't have to fire me.
Well, you talk about the situation in academia, and I look at it overall. I mean, I would chance to say that this issue, 9/11 truth and what happened at the towers, is one of the most censored issues out there. I mean, they will put out hit pieces to try to put down people making arguments for the case of controlled demolition. We got Richard on C-SPAN, but that took a year and a half of bombarding them and making that happen. But overall, this is the most censored issue, and you see it in academia, you see it in the media, you see it just in overall interactions with politicians here in the United States, the way they run from this topic when you talk to them about it. I don't think any of us ever saw this coming. And I was a pretty young man when 9/11 happened, so I didn't have a lot of perspective to look back on, but times were definitely different, and it's not been a good progression since then.
And it won't die. You know, I told you in the beginning that I were giving presentations to uninitiated people, and I'm being invited, say, in a society, and I get 30 good citizens who know absolutely nothing. And the revelation, just watching Building 7 going down, is shocking to most people. So this issue will never die. I don't think it will die. I don't think push it under the rock. They can hide it under the carpet. They can't do that. It will keep popping up. And it's the soft belly of the dragon, really. Still, it is.
That's right. And, you know, we're doing our job to keep this issue alive. And I think we've done such a good job that people can't even say Building 7 without thinking controlled demolition. Whether they want to agree with us or not, the first thing that they will think about is the idea of controlled demolition there. So that is our hallmark. And we're only going to improve from there. I want to know about you. And you may have said this years ago when you were on this show, but I don't remember it. How did you even get involved in this? Like, when did you come to know that there was a problem with the official story, and how did you get tapped to look into what's in the dust?
My discovery, that is a classic, actually. My wife had sent to her a DVD with anonymously by somebody who we later found out who was. And that was a presentation given by Professor Jones from Brigham Young University. And I saw it casually, and then suddenly Building 7 came up, and this was in 2006. And this is about the time when most people are discovering Building 7, around 2006. And this is due to the advent of YouTube. You may imagine that prior to 2005, there was no videos on the internet. So they didn't count on that when they, let's say, organized 9/11. There were no videos. But it took speed in 2005, 2006, when people actually could see for themselves what was going on. But I watched Building 7 on collapsing on a DVD, and that was a shocker. You know, two airliners, three skyscrapers. What is happening? That's one thing. And why haven't anyone told me about this? And the other thing is my training as a scientist, trying to understand what's going on. And I'm sorry. I think I'm pretty good at it most of the time. But this, I couldn't understand why this building should suddenly collapse like that. And what happens next is what happened to most. You get a feeling that this is painful. This is not somewhere I want to go. I do not want to pursue this trail. So I tried to forget it for a couple of weeks, but then it came back, and I realized that I had to take a look at it again. Half a year later, I wrote an essay for a newspaper. I had never done that up until that time. And by accident, it ended up in a newspaper. It's always a slip by some... When we get into the mainstream press, it's always a slip by a younger journalist. And this happened, and in that essay, in that newspaper, there was nothing besides the, hey, look, there were three skyscrapers. And I was very naive at the time. I thought that if you stood up on a soapbox in the corner of Regent's Park, Speaker's Corner in London, and just shouted the truth out in the vacuum in the air, it would proceed on its own. But then absolutely nothing happened. So I realized that I had to put together a presentation, which I knew I was pretty good at from my university training and my life as a musician, you know, addressing people. But that's not how I got involved with Jones. That was because I was reviewing a paper for a journal called The Environmentalist, written by Kevin Ryan and cohorts. Stephen Jones was on, Frank Legge, I think, was also on, and a couple of other guys, about the emissions from Ground Zero in the air, in The Environmentalist. I was a referee on that paper. And what happened was then, you know, the referee usually is anonymous. The authors do not know the reviewers. But the reviewer, of course, knows the authors. And the reviewer, the referee, has the freedom to contact the authors. And this, I have done that a couple of times. It's a great advantage in that situation, because if you communicate with the authors directly, you can say, hey, I have this and that. I do not like it. I have this, what do you call it? Complaints about the paper. But if you correct it and submit it again, everything will be much easier because I do not have to write a report. So, but by and large, I got into correspondence with them, and actually indirectly contributed to the paper. And afterwards, Kevin, from Stephen, invited me to join the team investigating the chips, and I was very honored, actually, to be asked, and it developed from there. Stephen Jones published the discovery of the chips in Boston on December the 13th, 2007. At that time, the work actually was going. So it was about 18 months it took until the final paper came out in April 3rd, 2009. And from one day to another, I was catapulted into global recognition due to, again, a slip from a journalist, because there was a Danish TV station. This was on Friday. And on Monday, there was a Danish TV station who wanted me to come by to their news broadcast, something which is, they're repeating it all the time. They make a news clip, and it's being, will be shown probably 10 times an evening. And they asked me to come by and say something about this discovery, which was broken. It was actually by a Danish science site called science.dk. They got the privilege of breaking these news. So the Danish TV station asked me to come on Monday evening and say 10 minutes about this, which I did. And I asked a friend of mine, hey, I'm going on television, can't you record it? But I can't see that station. He said, okay, but please ask somebody else to record it. I said, okay, I'll do my best. And what happened then this clip was shown only once from that TV station. Usually they show it 10 times. But there was an editor who said, hey, take it off. But it was recorded, so we could put it up on YouTube later on, and I don't know, it has passed 600,000 views now. So again, a little thing accidentally, because my friend, he took his bike the next day and went out to see his friend who had recorded it. And then it took off from there.
I know you're hard at work. You didn't just stop with the paper. You've been giving presentations. And I just want, for new listeners who may be just getting familiar with you for the first time, and we're talking about the paper and the chips, pretending that you're talking to somebody who has only the most basic chemistry education, and you've only got a few minutes to do it, what were basically the findings of the paper? What's the meat and potatoes of what you presented in those pages?
Well, you can't do that in 3 minutes, actually. Actually, when I'm doing a presentation, it takes me usually 2 hours to bring a complete uninitiated person with no knowledge in chemistry until understanding, getting a coherent collapse scenario of World Trade Center. And Richard probably does the same thing. And at that time we did not know where do the nanothermite fits in. It wasn't up until 2011 I really got the point, but we may return to that. Thermite is an old invention. It was published, the chemical reaction was published for the first time in 1893 by a German chemist called Hans Goldschmidt, who discovered when you mix aluminum powder and pulverized rust, let us say that, if you can make them react, the reaction is extremely violent and can reach temperatures of 2,500 degrees centigrade. I don't know how many Fahrenheit that is, but it's about 1,000 degrees beyond the melting point of iron and steel. And it produces molten iron in the process at extreme high temperature. So it's a very useful reaction because it produces molten iron. It can be used for welding and was patented as such already in 1898. But it can also use for destruction. But as an incendiary, it acts by means of heat, while an explosive acts by means of force. An explosive knocks things apart, but an incendiary burns it. Or it's not a fire. It's very, very hot. The point I said that the old time thermite, Hans Goldschmidt thermite, is made by mixing the ingredients, pulverized aluminum and pulverized rust. It's two powders. But then nanotechnology came along in the 1980s, late 80s, early 90s, which is completely different way of making materials. You do not mix things from top down. You make the materials bottom up. That is, you trick the chemistry to make the materials atom by atom or molecule by molecule, bottom up. So it's a fundamentally different way of making materials. Nanotechnology. In this case, it means that the ingredients, which in this case is iron oxide, rust, and aluminum, the ingredients, the particles, are much smaller, and they are embedded in a plastic matrix which makes them much, much easier to handle. But you still have the energy. Now I have to talk about energy, because the thermite reaction has a lot of energy, but it's very slow compared with explosives. Many people think that explosives are very energetic. They are not. They are, but they are extremely fast. I mean, you get more energy out of burning a log of wood, but it takes hours. But if you blow the same energy in microseconds, you get the explosive effect. So explosives are very, very fast. Thermite, old-time thermite, is very slow but has a lot of energy. But with nanotechnology, you could take advantage of the high energy content of the thermite reaction and gain the speed of the explosive, because the ingredients, the particles, are so small. And that makes you in a position where you can tune the material, which now we call it energetic materials. You could tune it on a scale from incendiary to explosive. And in between, you have something like rocket fuel. Rocket fuel is also very energetic, but if it is faster than an incendiary, but it's not as fast as an explosive. If it was, the rocket would blow up. So it should release, a rocket fuel should release a gas with high speed, but not too high speed. Then the thing will explode. And the gas you release from the rocket fuel and the explosives can do work. It can take things apart, or it can lift the rocket. So this is the situation in the 90s, the 1990s, where military discovered this opportunity for using the thermite reaction, the energy in the thermite reaction, to have the material to do work. You can make explosives from the thermite reaction, and you can make rocket fuel. You can tune the thing. And many people have called what the nanothermite we found, have called it a military-grade explosive. I disagree. We don't know that, and I don't believe it, because my colleague, he has made a recording of a reacting nano chip under microscope, and you can see how it swells, how a gas is being evolved, but it's not explosive. It's more like a rocket fuel. So for a long time, I couldn't make things fit together. Another independent discovery was the sulfidation of the steel, which did not fit into the nanothermite either, because we could not account for that. We did not. There was no sulfur in the nanothermite. But as you know, you can add sulfur to the thermite reaction and get thermate, which is very well fitted for cutting through steel beams. And also you had the discovery of the iron spheres in the dust, huge quantities. So, and you could watch on television how the steel beams and the girders were being hurled out from the twin towers. So work was being done. Explosives can do work. They can move things around. But it wasn't until Dave Chandler did this video called Smoking Guns, the South Tower Collapsing. Because he took a closer look on the fragments being thrown out from the Twin Towers. And then suddenly everything fell into place, because when you have the thermite reaction, I said, you form elemental iron, but you also form aluminum oxide, and that is white. If you fire the thermite reaction on the floor in the laboratory, you see a little white cloud over the reaction, and that is aluminum oxide. It is white. And Chandler brilliantly took a closer look on the fragments coming out of the South Tower. And there were fragments which was accelerating faster than free fall. and you will, and there were fragments which changed trajectory. Suddenly they were making a 90 degrees turn, and they were wiggling, they were not falling naturally. And then suddenly the whole thing snapped, because this is, as I believed, the nanothermite in action. Not as an explosive, not as a rocket fuel, but as something in between. We're missing the word here. There is no word for it. What I see is the nanothermite serving as something between an explosive and a rocket fuel, which you always call a propellant. That's a technical term for rocket fuel. And once you've seen it, you know, everything fits. So a coherent collapse scenario for World Trade Center requires three energetic materials. Explosives are being used, obviously. And we don't know the chemical composition of these explosives. They could be conventional, what we call molecular explosives, or they could be thermitic. We don't know that. Also, you see steel beams being cut. And this is done by Thermate, and Jonathan Barnett's work has proven unambitiously the Thermate was used to cut the steel beams. And the third energetic material, this is what I believe is a hypothesis, but it fits nicely, is that the nanothermite served for blowing the steel beams and the girders out of the Twin Towers, because every fragment you see being thrown out from the Twin Towers draws after a completely homogeneous white smoke trail. Now, what is that? Is it concrete? No. If you throw out a piece of concrete through the window, it will not trace a white smoke trail. Is it wallboard? No. There's a chemical reaction going. The smoke is white. And my claim was that this is aluminum oxide. And I presented that at the Toronto hearings in 2011. I took a chance. I must admit, I hold my breath and I took a chance. But then David Chandler went back home and actually traced some of the fragments and discovered that they are moving faster than freefall. One of the fragments coming out of the South Tower is accelerating to the ground with 11 meters per second squared. This is faster than freefall. And this is only possible if there is a driving force, a thrust, adding to gravity. And once you've seen it, next, I'm showing Chandler's videos of North Tower and the South Tower in my presentation. I've seen it probably 1,000 times now, and I'm still in awe by the scenario. Because once you've seen it, it's so obvious what is happening. You know, the canopy of debris, the mushroom cloud, it's white. Think about it next time you see it. It's completely ridiculous. And it's what I mean by ridiculous is that this is a scenario which has been watched by billions of people, billions of times all over the world, again and again and again. And nobody sees what they see, which is a key obstacle to actually see what you see. We may return to this.
Yeah, and some people see what they see, but they choose to unsee it. And I think that's a huge obstacle as well. Plus, we have a whole group of people out there who try to debate us on the facts. It doesn't usually work out too well for them, but they've got media on their side and a lot of hubris. When that falls apart, they go after little anecdotes, little side issues that have nothing to do with science. And one thing we wanted to address today, because this comes up a lot, and I've got my own answer to this, but I'm going to let you respond to it first, is there was some controversy when the paper got published at the Bentham Open Chemical Physics Journal involving the editor resigning because it was published. He came under some heat for that. Can you just quickly tell that story and give your own commentary on that situation?
Yeah, I got mad on the Danish journalist because he was the one who called the editor. And Madame Pilani, what is her name, did the only thing she could do in that situation. If you look up her CV, you'll see that she had been working for the French military and sitting in the commission for explosives. And she was probably still is a high ranking within the nanotechnology discipline. She was the head of an institute on nanotechnology in Paris. She did the only thing that she could do in that situation, and that was to resign and say, well, I can't read the paper, which is completely, of course she could read the paper. But she said, well, it's not my field, I can't read it, which was bullshit. So she saved her job. If she had said, well, I can read it, she had two options. Either it's wrong or it's right. And she couldn't do that. Say it's wrong, which means that we are right. And since we are right, or according to how she reacted, we must be right. Because if we had been wrong, if we had made mistakes, she could have said that. That saved her reputation and her job. But she didn't. She said, well, I'm sorry, I cannot read it, and I'm resigning. So she did the only thing she could do, and I don't blame her for that. If she wanted to keep her position as a high-ranking academic. And that's the story. And she claimed that it had been published without her knowledge. People have naive understanding of how academic publication is working. You said in the introduction, I've published more than 50 papers. It's more than 60, actually. And it's not actually, many of my colleagues have made hundreds. I have never communicated with a chief editor. You don't communicate with, very rarely, if there's only one people in editorial. But usually you're communicating with the secretary who's doing all the things. And the chief editor is only somebody sitting on the top and putting her or his name on the journal, and that's it. They don't mingle with the daily routines. So there's nothing unusual in that at all. And it was reviewed according to common procedures. Actually, one of the referees was a little pain in the ass because he requested additional control experiments, which delayed the whole thing for 3 months. I was a little pissed. But in the end, actually, the paper got better because we had more time to refine some of the arguments. And so maybe I should thank him for that one day. So there was nothing unusual in the whole thing. There were four reasons for why this paper was chosen. Because first, it's open. It's an open journal. It means that you can read it. Otherwise, you would have to pay to read it. And second, it's a very long. I should add, but this is made an irrelevant story. Why we have open journals at all? It's because all the publishing companies had cranked up the subscription fees to the old journals, so they were beyond reach for ordinary people, ordinary scientists, to subscribe to the old journals. So during the 80s, there was this movement for the open journals. The scientists have always paid for having their stuff published, either by subscription or by what is called page chart. So there's nothing new in that you actually put the things out for free and then you pay for the production cost. This was an open journal, but this was selected for four reasons. First, it was an open journal. You can read it. Everyone can read it. Otherwise, I'm not in the university anymore, so I have to go to the library if there's anything I want to read. That's one thing. Second, it was a very long paper. And usually, if there is a printed version, you do not accept long papers because it's simply too costly to print them. Third, in an open journal, we keep the copyrights of all the pictures, all the pictures in the paper. We maintain the copyrights. If it had been one of the old journals, the copyright goes to the publisher. So if you want to use one of the pictures, you have to ask the publisher every time. And fourth, my dean, the top boss here at the University of Copenhagen, was on the advisory board, external advisory board, and his name was Anderson, so he was even on top of the list. So it was my super boss here, my dean for science at the University of Copenhagen, was an endorser of this journal. And this was a good four reasons for publishing it there. What's more to add about this? The most important thing of our conversation here is, if you may have noticed, that I am submitting to you a coherent collapse scenario for World Trade Center. There's nothing we do not understand now. There's many things we do not know, like the chemical identities of the explosives. But there's nothing we do not understand. And there's no contradictions. It's consistent, coherent.
That's right, and the evidence is solid, and because of the work of yourself and so many others who are on that paper, the 9/11 Truth Movement, the laymen out there who haven't taken all the time to study the subjects as well as you have something that can be presented to our politicians, can be presented to the media. I mean, we got a gentleman out there who buys a copy of this paper and sends it out to various media outlets, like the New York Times and such, on a consistent basis as part of his outreach. And so this thing has been floated around more than you and I will ever even know, probably. And that's why we're talking about it today, because it's the 10th anniversary of this paper being around.
Yeah, and do you remember Joe Biden had it handed to him? Did you see that?
I don't remember that specific instance. I know a lot of politicians have had it handed to them. Tell us about that. He might be president next.
Yeah, I can send you the video, actually. But I cannot, there's also, I don't remember, this was this activist from California, from We Are Change, Los Angeles, I think. We Are Change Los Angeles. He was tracking down politicians and confronting them on camera in the public domain, and one of them was Joe Biden. So you're coming president. No, we don't think that. But at least he is running for the Democrats now. He has seen the paper. He's got it in his hand. He's turning around and he's running away. I can send it to you when we close this conversation. And I remember a picture, a photograph, a still photograph, where afterwards, where Joe Biden is having a quiet moment and he's sitting down and looking through it. I cannot find it again. But what I have on my desktop is the video where he's actually being handed the paper. And he's running away.
It's ridiculous. You know, on C-SPAN, we had Tom Ridge, the director of Homeland Security. At that point, he was formerly director. And I asked him about your research about why they didn't test the dust for incendiaries or explosives. And his answer was not to address it scientifically or even give a logistical reason as to why they didn't. He said something to the effect, I don't have the direct quote handy in my brain, but he said something to the effect that that would fall within our purview, but if the assertion is that explosives were used to bring down the Twin Towers, I reject that categorically, and kind of leered at the camera. That's the response of politicians to science. They can't debunk it. They can't figure out how to handle the situation other than to feign outrage at the fact that the question was asked, and that is exactly what we're dealing with. Here's my question to you. You mentioned about saying you thought you could just put that up into the air and that the truth would sort of move forward. I started out that way, too. I thought I could just create a MySpace page and wake people up and they would say, oh, my God, this is terrible. We need to have a worldwide movement. And, of course, it didn't work out that way. I'm a little older and wiser now. But did you expect the kind of backlash that you received? I mean, I would chance it to say that you hadn't received this kind of controversy with previous papers you had published. Was it a shock to you that there was so much resistance?
Absolutely. You know, I've published many papers. One thing is like the chain of custody for these samples. Just to show you an example how when we wrote up the paper, because there's we had five samples at that time. But the fifth of them, the person who had delivered them to us did not want to come forward. So we removed all the data from that sample, and there's only four samples in the paper. And the people who had submitted them, their videos, how they got the samples, where they found it, the exact timing, they have signed affidavits for swearing how they got it, how they had been stored, how it was passed on to us, etc., etc. The chain of custody for these samples. So I thought that was ridiculous. I said to the other guys, hey, never in my lifetime have I experienced or can I imagine that anyone would claim or would charge us for falsifying the samples mingling with the samples. But the others, Jones in particular, claimed, no, we've got to have this in. But I said, why should we spend three pages on that? I said, we have to do that. He was right. I was wrong. Because how many people have come and said, well, how are you sure that they have not been tangled with these samples? I said, where's the chain of custody in the paper? This was the response. I thought it was ridiculous. But Jones was right.
No, we got to fight for every inch. The normal rules do not apply when it comes to this issue. I mean, we've got news sites taking down articles within hours of them getting published now when they just report even-handedly about our lawsuit. I mean, we're at a level of censorship now I never thought we would have seen in this country in particular. And so that's just the latest manifestation of this entire censorship curtain that we've been dealing with. And so, yeah, we have to document everything. And to which case I agree with documenting everything, because there's a lot of people that are going to mentally resist this. I've had people make arguments, smart people try to make arguments that there may have been an earthquake or something that brought down Building 7 on September 11th. I mean, that's ridiculous. That would be horrible luck for the city of New York to have an earthquake the same day as 9/11. But they will go to those extents in their mind to try to avoid what is obviously right in front of them. And it used to be that people would get angry about this. The media would feed this mass outrage by acting so disdainful and putting on little sour faces on TV when they would talk about this issue. But I've noticed some changes myself. Before I kind of pollute the response from you with my own observations, in your own view, do you feel that the environment has gotten better or worse in the general public, not the media or the government, but in the general public and being able to be more open-minded to this issue?
It's getting better. We're doing also quite a bit of street activism, you know, passing out flyers. Prior to when I'm giving a presentation, we usually go out and pass out flyers. And years ago, people, as you say, would be angry and yelling at you and calling you things. Now they politely, they're interested and say, oh, and say thank you. It has changed. But I think that's a general pattern because nobody trusts authority anymore so much. I mean, it's cracking. We have been fooled so many times and they're quite open. They don't even pretend that they don't make excuses for invading Venezuela anymore. They just do it. I mean, they've given up fooling people. So I think this is a general trend. people are being more. And here in Europe, we have social movements. You have may heard about the yellow vests.
Right.
And you may have heard about Brexit. You may have heard about there's a German protest party. We're having elections for the European Union here on this Sunday. And there have been many. So the people don't trust the authority, the powers, so much anymore. And they can feel on. It's not some consciously. They can just feel it. And I think 9/11 goes along with that. And we can take our share, in all modesty, for this this change, because it's bound to happen, and it's going to be big.
I mean, I think 9/11 truth for a lot of people started the distrust. And everything that happens, I have family members that call me and keep me in line with what's going on in the news because I don't watch a lot of it myself. I'm so busy now. And they fret over it. And I say, well, to a certain extent, though, the fact that the powers that be have so much hubris and the fact that people are distrusting them so much now and they're acting this way is a good thing if they don't create a huge disaster in the process or do something that can't be undone. Because assuming those things don't happen or somehow we have a miracle and they just undo themselves, that'll be great conditions for us, because then people will have a big wake-up call from whatever happens as a result of the system getting out of control. And they're going to look back to people like yourself, people like AE911 Truth, the folks here, and say, hey, you know, these guys were talking about the World Trade Center. I never did trust that story. Maybe we should look into this again. We know that the system did this, this, and this openly. They got caught. Now, maybe we should look at 9/11 again, because that's probably something that we were lied to about as well. So we just got to.
Well, some people may, but the mainstream journalists and the politicians will not. You'll not get the Pulitzer Prize.
So, in our last question to you today, you know, we're 10 years out from when you wrote that paper, and 9/11 Truth, I don't know what the birth date of 9/11 Truth is. It started probably practically on that day. But, you know, here we are in 2019. What do you think, as a truth leader, the movement should be doing more or less to educate the public and keep us on that track?
In terms of documentation, in terms of exposing the narrative, we have won. I mean, we're through. There's nothing left from an academic point of view to prove. So what is going on now, what architects and engineers are doing with the lawsuit is absolutely perfectly fitting. And I think Leroy Halse's work will probably also get some momentum in. But we are... It's more important now to inform people about the basics, the official narrative is wrong. And also, please notice one thing. I don't know what it is in America, but around here, the concept of false flags is now common language. This was not the situation just two years ago or 3 years ago. That's one thing. False flags, everybody knows now what a false flag is, also because of Syria. They didn't 3 years ago. I don't know what it is in America. And they're waiting for pulling a false flag on Iran. They will probably shoot down some airliner. But I mean, they can't do it anymore. Everybody will cry out and say false flag. Or could you imagine what that could be? Something nuclear? But Iran does not have any nuclear weapons. Neither do Venezuela. So what can they come up with next? They can't.
Yeah, you even have mainstream joke publications making fun of the presidential advisor now, John Bolton, doing false flags on himself. So even when you have the mainstream joke publications doing that, that is a good sign. They don't trust what's going on either. And so, no, we've done our job in that respect, and we're going to keep doing our job until we have the final victory, which is full acknowledgement of what happened so that everybody knows it, and the children learn it in the history books, too. And that day will come, and then we're going to see
it. It'll be in my lifetime, and I'm an old man.
That's right. So, Niels, we are at the end of the show today, and it's flown by for me. I love talking to you, and I'm glad we got the Denmark connection worked out at the beginning of the show. Thank you for all that you've done and that you're doing and for coming on the show today.
Same to you. Thank you, Andy.
This program is on every Thursday night on No Lies Radio at 10 o'clock Eastern, 7 o'clock Pacific. You can also keep track of the archives by going to 911freefall.com. This is Andy Steele. So you have a great week. Good luck.